Advanced Journalism Institute at the Missouri School of Journalism. Welcome to Global Journalist. I'm Jason McClure. Two figures have dominated the politics of Southern Africa in recent years. One is Zimbabwe's 93-year-old President Robert Mugabe. The other is South Africa's 75-year-old President Jacob Zuma. Now, Mugabe is in military custody after an apparent coup d'etat brought an end to his 37-year rule. Meanwhile, in South Africa, Zuma is set to be replaced as the leader of the ruling African National Congress next month and may be forced to step down from his 8-year-old presidency before the end of his term in 2019. Now, the potential departure of both men from the political scene leaves Southern Africa at a crossroads. In particular, both Zimbabwe and South Africa have faced enormous challenges with political corruption that has mushroomed under both Mugabe and Zuma. Still, there is reason for optimism that both countries have a brighter future. On this edition of Global Journalist, a look at South Africa in transition. Now, in a few minutes, we're going to speak with some people who have been following the contest in South Africa's ruling African National Congress to succeed Jacob Zuma. But first, we're going to bring in John Campbell in Washington, D.C. He's a former U.S. diplomat who is stationed in a number of countries, including South Africa. He's now a senior fellow for Africa policy at the Council on Foreign Relations and is the author of the book Mourning in South Africa. John, welcome.
Thank you very much. It's good to be with you.
Well, Zimbabwe has been in the economic doldrums for a long time now, and Mugabe at 93 has also been frail for quite some time. What do we know about why the military seized power now?
It seems pretty clear that the fundamental issue was who is going to succeed Mugabe when either he dies or becomes completely incapacitated. Two wings within the ruling party, or at least two, the ruling party is ZANU-PF. One wing is associated with those who are veterans of the liberation struggle, closely identified with Emmerson Mnangagwa.
And this is the liberation struggle that took place in the 1970s that eventually ousted the white settlers, white British settlers who ruled what was then Rhodesia.
That's correct. That's right. Ian Smith was the prime minister at the time. The other faction is led by Mugabe's wife, Grace, often called G40. They're younger. They are too young to have participated in the liberation struggle. Grace herself was only 15 when Zimbabwe shook off minority white rule. So two factions contesting with each other over the succession.
So these are almost, you make it sound like there's almost a generational struggle within Zimbabwe's ruling party then over this.
That's exactly right.
Well, tell us about...
It's a generational struggle, but it's also a matter of personality. It is not particularly a matter of policy. In other words, this is a struggle within the ruling party.
Well, you highlight these two factions here, and you mentioned Grace Mugabe, President Mugabe's 54-year-old wife, and the leader of the other faction, the sort of war veterans faction, is a guy who was until recently Vice President Emmerson Mnangagwa. What do we know about his whereabouts, his involvement in what's taken place?
Emmerson was vice president up until last weekend, when, in apparently a fit of pique, Mugabe fired him. And I think it was the firing of him that directly precipitated the coup, because by firing him, Mugabe was signaling that between the two factions, he was going to favor that of his wife. As to where he is right now, I don't know. There are rumors, and sometimes even more than rumors, that he went to South Africa, and that would be quite logical. Whether he has returned to Zimbabwe or not, I don't really know.
And President Mugabe has been taken into custody by the military. What do we know about the whereabouts of his wife, Grace Mugabe?
Again, there are conflicting reports. The army, the military, has said that she is in custody with her husband. On the other hand, there are rumors that she has fled to Namibia. It remains to be seen.
Well, what are we to make of this? Does the military's move, does it have popular support? Do either one of these factions, are they sort of carrying the street? Are they carrying sort of broad-based popular backing with them?
It's very interesting. Harare is quiet. Banks are open. Shops are open. Not many people on the streets. Anecdotal evidence that people are satisfied with the prospect of change. But now that's in Harare and in Bulawayo, the principal cities in the country. Mugabe's support has always been in rural areas, and I have seen no credible reports as to what the reaction there is. I do find it interesting that thus far there has been no military there's been no fighting on behalf of Mugabe. And in fact, up to now, this coup has been relatively peaceful.
So in other words, there don't appear to be divisions within the army over who is going to be loyal to President Mugabe and who is going to be loyal to the coup leaders. Who are the leaders of this coup?
Well, the nominal leader of it is the chief of the army. And when the chief of the army gave a press conference earlier in the week, in effect threatening to do what eventually they did do, which is intervene, he was accompanied by no less than 90 senior military leaders, a good indication that the military is indeed united.
Well, our time does grow short, but John, could you tell us what has been the international reaction to this? What have sort of Zimbabwe's regional partners said about this coup? What has the United States and Western countries said?
The regional partners, the African Union and the Southern African Economic Community, both are on record as opposing coups. Of course, those that carried out the coup are denying that it was a coup. In the United States, the State Department has issued a, to my mind, rather wishy-washy statement, essentially calling for restraint and the protection of constitutional liberties. Members of Congress have been a bit blunter. What they, in effect, have been saying, those that have commented publicly, is that the removal of Mugabe is a very good thing indeed. The way he was removed, however, was unfortunate. And generally, what members of Congress do is go on to say that a transitional government should be established as quickly as possible that will move the country towards democratic and civilian government.
Well, John Campbell, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
A reminder that this is Global Journalist. On today's program, a look at the future of Southern Africa as Zimbabwe's President Robert Mugabe is toppled by a coup d'etat and South Africa's ruling African National Congress prepares to choose a successor to President Jacob Zuma. We just spoke with John Campbell of the Council on Foreign Relations. To expand our discussion, we're going to bring in three other people who have been tracking the region's politics closely. Joining us via Skype is Stephen Friedman, a political scientist at the University of Johannesburg. Also in Johannesburg is Stembile Sile, a reporter for City Press newspaper in Johannesburg. And finally, we're joined by Gareth Newham. He's the head of the Justice and Violence Program at the Institute for Security Studies in Pretoria. Welcome to all of you. Stephen Friedman, if I could start with you. President Zuma in South Africa has been fairly supportive of Zimbabwe's government, of President Mugabe over the years, despite the economic crisis there, despite well-documented human rights abuses. How has the South African government responded to this?
Well, the South African government has responded by trying to send envoys to negotiate a settlement. Its public position, which is probably also its non-public position, is that it's opposed to the coup, that it wants to negotiate an arrangement which will in effect reverse the coup. What seems to be happening at the moment is that some quite intense negotiations are taking place. about how to manage what has happened over the last couple of days. South Africa's role in that is not particularly clear at this stage.
Who would be the key actors in these negotiations? President Mugabe is 93. Is he still involved in negotiating things like this, or is it the people around him?
Well, no, he's perfectly capable of, I mean, he may be 93 and ailing, but he's perfectly capable of clinging onto power, which is what he's trying to do at the moment. The reports today say that he's taking the view that he is the elected head of government and he's not going to be removed. I would be extremely skeptical about this because I think that the reality in Zimbabwe today, which a lot of the reporting is not picking up, is that the generals have really been the de facto government in Zimbabwe for quite some time. They're the power behind the throne. A few years ago, Mr. Mugabe tried to step down. They wouldn't let him. So in effect, if it comes to a clash of wills between Mr. Mugabe and the generals, then I think it's reasonable to expect that the generals will win.
Well, let me turn this to you, Stembile Sile. How are people in South Africa reacting to the coup? How are ordinary people feeling? Is there relief? Is there fear that there could be violence or you know, sort of economic spillover into South Africa?
I think there was certainly a brief excitement when this whole thing started. Probably a misdirected sort of feeling to have towards it, given that the situation has been so dire in Zimbabwe for so long. And of course, we've seen the effects of this with so many Zimbabweans flocking to South Africa as an economic haven of sorts. So lots of uncertainty, social media also not assisting with so much, you know, you have fake news, you have pictures from ages ago being used now as if it's a current situation. So I think just a great amount of uncertainty, but also a sense of hope that things could get better for Zimbabwe. Of course, that in itself might be a complicated situation as well. As was explained earlier with the two factions that are opposing each other, it's essentially the same party that is having this infighting. And so it kind of makes you wonder if anything will change, should this coup even be successful at all for the masses of Zimbabweans that have lived, as I said, in these dire conditions for so long.
So in other words, then it sounds like you're picking up on that point that Stephen was making, which is that the generals have been the power behind the throne for a long time and that this is just sort of a shuffling of who the figurehead is in charge of the government.
Absolutely. And certainly from Zimbabweans living in South Africa, I have a housemate, in fact, that is from Zimbabwe. And there was a brief excitement there as well in the country. But for the most part, people are like, things are probably going to remain the same. And I think there's also just a sense of gratefulness that at this stage, there's been no bloodshed. Things have been relatively, in fact, they have been completely peaceful. But I get the sense that the longer these negotiations drag on, and it seems like Mugabe very reluctant to let go of power, that could see a different situation unfolding. But for now, it's just a great sense of if things can remain peaceful, that would be the best outcome.
Well, what about the role of Zimbabwe's opposition, Stembile, the Movement for Democratic Change, its leader Morgan Tsvangirai, ran some very close elections against Mugabe. Some people said they would have won if it weren't for violence in the past. Where are they in all of this?
He actually came out and made some statements today saying that it's his belief that Mugabe really must go. He's overstayed his welcome, as has been his position. And I think what will be interesting to see, in fact, if we are to be less sort of suspicious of this movement, is that should they bring on board the likes of Tsvangirai, other opposition parties, other stakeholders, as it were, we'd get a more sense of credibility that there is change that's coming, even in terms of the makeup of the transitional government. If it's made up of other players outside of ZANU-PF, I think it will give credibility to what's happening. Otherwise, it is just the status quo remaining and a different political head for the same organization.
Well, Gareth Newham, if I could turn this to South Africa's politics for a moment. Jacob Zuma has been in power for 8 years there. You've argued that he is, during his rule, South Africa's governance has deteriorated significantly over that time. Tell us a bit about your view, your research on that.
Well, there has been a lot of information about that more recently. We track quite closely the situation relating to crime, to the performance of a criminal justice system, and to various indicators of corruption. And certainly, the last 5 years, we've seen, for example, quite a big increase in the murder rate. Between 1992 and 2012, murder rate dropped by 54% in South Africa. But for the last 5 years, murder rate has increased by 13%. Similarly, we've seen a big increase in armed robberies across the country. There were 40,000 more armed attacks across the country last year than there were 5 years ago. And this is a result of very poor leadership appointments to head the police, head the intelligence, head the National Prosecuting Authority. So the performance of these agencies has deteriorated as Jacob Zuma has appointed people he sees as very loyal to him. Some of them have been very unethical. Some of them are facing allegations of corruption. And that has really weakened that system. But we've seen the same across the public service, and particularly more recently, big deterioration in the governance of our state-owned enterprises that provide electricity, the railway services, the public broadcaster, and so forth, all who had people pointed to their boards very close to the president and his backers. So, yes, I think there's a general sense, and the evidence is there for everybody to see, that we would be in a much better place if Jacob Zuma was completely committed to clean democratic governance, and he has not been, from the evidence available.
Well, Stephen Friedman, there was a report this year that got a lot of attention in South Africa, around the world, that said Zuma had allowed the South African state to be captured by business interests close to him, if you will. In particular, this one family, this Indian immigrant family named the Guptas. What was the significance of this report?
Well, I think the point to be made about this, look, the idea here is, and that is well documented, that the Gupta family, who arrived here from India, have been able to buy the support of various politicians who do what the Gupta family want them to do. On the other hand, I think it's very important to stress that this is not, it's often reported as though this is an isolated incident and that it's some kind of aberration. Unfortunately, that's not the reality. It's simply a more brash version of some very deeply embedded patterns in our society and our economy. In effect, what we're seeing are the effects of the fact that in 1994, amidst great fanfare, we changed our political system and captured the world's attention because we did that. We didn't really change the fundamentals of the way the economy was run. And the way the economy is run is that you have insiders and outsiders, you have cozy cliques of insiders who deals with each other at the expense of outsiders. And certainly Mr. Zuma is complicit in this and the Gupta family are complicit in this, but it's part of a much deeper problem, which will only be solved when we open up when we have a far more open economy, a far more inclusive economy.
You're tuned into Global Journalist. I'm Jason McClure. On today's program, we're talking about some seismic political changes in Southern Africa. Zimbabwe's 93-year-old leader Robert Mugabe has been toppled in an apparent coup. Meanwhile, in the regional power South Africa, the ruling African National Congress is preparing to choose a successor to President Jacob Zuma. We're joined by Stephen Friedman of the University of Johannesburg, Stembile Sile of City Paper in Johannesburg, and Gareth Newham of the Institute for Security Studies in the capital, Pretoria. If you're interested in more Global Journalists, check us out online at globaljournalist.org. There you can find our archives and additional coverage of underreported international news and human rights issues. You can also like us on Facebook, where we live stream, follow us on Twitter, subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, or see our video cast on YouTube. Let me turn this to you, Stembile Sile. The ANC is scheduled to have this big party meeting next month where it will be decided who will succeed Zuma as party leader and presumably become president of South Africa, either in 2019 or possibly before. Tell us about one of those people. It's actually Jacob Zuma's ex-wife, Nkosazana Dlamini Zuma. She's held a number of cabinet posts in previous governments. What is her appeal?
Very correctly, as you stated, she's held a number of positions in cabinet. Most recently, though, she was outside of the country as a chairperson of the African Union body. So previously, she was in the previous administration under President Thabo Mbeki. That's where she served in those numerous cabinet posts that you mentioned, Minister of Health, Foreign Affairs, amongst them. And so I think initially her credentials spoke for themselves. There was, you know, this idea around her that she could be someone that is credible, that could be a great leader. But for the fact that she's received the endorsement or so-called anointment from Jacob Zuma. And so there's the sense that she's a proxy for him, that he will lead from behind or from the grave, as it were, through her. And I think just sort of the endorsements within the party that have come from people aligned to Jacob Zuma, they sort of give credence or they give weight to those allegations that she will serve as his proxy. And so it's basically tainted her entire campaign, not a lot of credibility. And also talk that should she actually be victorious in December, a great chance that the ANC could lose power to the extreme side, or they'd lose great support when we head to the polls in 2019.
And Zuma has a very vested interest in the outcome of this decision, because there has been talk that he may again face actually dozens, if not hundreds, of charges of corruption related to a weapons deal that occurred more than a decade ago that had been initially dropped against him. Is that not the case?
18 charges, 783 counts in total. And so the reports, or what we understood for the longest time, has been that he's chasing presidential pardon. And so if he has someone who he has this bond with, his former wife, they have four children together as well, so that relationship is there, is that he would then be exempt. He could receive some form of amnesty, perhaps, and then he would avoid some sort of jail sentence going forward. So he'd be protected in that sense. And that's why he then chose Dr. Dlamini Zuma as his successor.
Well, Gareth Newham, one of the other contenders is, I guess, one of the richest men in South Africa, Cyril Ramaphosa. What do we know about him?
Well, he was President Nelson Mandela's favorite choice to succeed him back in 1999, and Thabo Mbeki managed to outmaneuver him and become the new president following Nelson Mandela. This led Cyril Ramaphosa to leave politics and go into business, where he managed to amass a large amount of wealth, become very wealthy. He then joined Jacob Zuma's campaign to extend his presidential rule of the ANC back in 2012, on condition that he was the deputy president, and became the deputy president of the ANC and the deputy president of the country. And he is therefore one of the big contenders to replace Jacob Zuma. His camp have argued that he is not corrupt, there's no known allegations of corruption against him, that he was part of leading the team that negotiated our constitution, and that he would be the kind of person that would be able to bring back the vision of Nelson Mandela to the African National Congress and improve situation in the country. So he is the main contender against Nkosi Dlamini Zuma for the presidency of the ANC in December this year.
Well, Stephen Friedman, talk to us about the main opposition parties. The ANC obviously has been in charge of government, at least the national government, since the early 1990s. What is the role of the main opposition parties? Is there an opening for them to either win a coalition or make significant gains?
Well, for a variety of reasons, the opposition parties are not really in a position to hugely increase their support themselves. They have been doing rather well recently because of the travails of the African National Congress. And I think that the prospects for the 2019 election really depend fundamentally on what happens inside the ANC, the governing party, rather than the opposition parties. If you go back to our last local election, which was a very important election because it showed a very strong swing away from the governing party, this was in August 2016. What you found was that large numbers of supporters of the governing party stayed at home rather than vote. And obviously that boosted the opposition vote quite substantially. And I think we're looking at a similar situation. If you have a leader which is elected in December, who ANC voters feel more comfortable with, then you'll probably see a comfortable ANC majority in the 2019 election. If you have a leader who voters are not comfortable with, then you could well have a huge stay away again by ANC voters. So although the opposition parties, I mean, the main opposition is the Democratic Alliance, which is particularly strong in the more affluent suburbs of the cities. It has a very loyal support base, but it doesn't have a huge base among the vast majority of voters who live in the poorer areas of the country. So really, what happens to South Africa in 2019 is going to depend on what the governing party does and not on what the opposition does.
Well, Stembile Sile, we've talked about some of the problems inside the ANC. We talked about some of the corruption problems that Zuma faces, this issue of state capture. But tell us about the party's supporters. It has won a majority in every national election. I think a lot of people would be surprised if it doesn't win a majority at the next election. What are the main reasons for its support? Why is it still so enduringly popular?
So my sense is that for the longest time, the ANC has gotten its support from a loyalty vote more than anything else, particularly an older generation that was involved in the liberation movement. And so they've, for the longest time, associated with the ANC, with a sense of freedom. They brought liberty to this country. And so, they were the people's party in that sense. But there is, I think, growing discontent over the past few years. I mean, we're at about 23 years now since the ANC took over governing of the country. And there's a sense that things just haven't happened the way that they were imagined to happen, particularly at a local level, where you speak of service delivery, water, running water not being available to people, electricity not being available to people. And then you have these scandals also around the president and other leaders, and leaders that have kept quiet and in that sense have been complicit in the degeneration of the ANC, certainly from a moral perspective, with these charges of corruption that we've spoken about. And so people that once were sort of, I don't want to say they were, automatically voted for the ANC in the sense that, they didn't really think too much about their vote. Now there's a number of considerations. There's reports that are coming in daily about state-owned enterprises not being run well, corruption, infighting within the party. And all of these things, I think, are culminating. And voters are like, actually, maybe we should start looking at our other options. Also, the rise of something like the EFF. I mean, they don't have a really great significant voter base at this stage, but they do. They come from the ANC, first of all, so they speak the ANC language in that sense. But also, it's an alternative where there hasn't been one before. And so there's a number of factors that I think that are leading voters to think, actually, we can do something different, and we will. Either we stay away because there is no alternative, or we gamble and give our votes to someone else because the ANC just not doing what we thought that they would do.
And Gareth Newham, our time grows short in just about 30 seconds. Give us your perspective. Where do you see South Africa 3 years from now? Where do you see Zimbabwe?
Well, I would like to see South Africa recovering from a period of high levels of corruption, which dampened the economy. As Stephen Friedman said, a lack of inclusive growth, a lack of inclusion in the economy. So I would like to see a situation in which we have a political party that is able to bring South Africans together, change the structure of our economy, bring more people in out of poverty so that we can see a brighter future. That's what I hope. But of course, I can't read the future, so I won't be able to say what will actually happen. We'll have to wait and see.
That's going to have to do it for this edition of Global Journalist, a production of the Missouri School of Journalism and KBIA, Mid-Missouri Public Radio. Many thanks to John Campbell, Gareth Newham, Stembile Sile, and Stephen Friedman for joining us. Our assistant producers this week are Juwan Choi, Lexi Churchill, and Samantha Lucas, with supervising producer Rachel Foster Gimbel. Elisa Blyle is visual editor, Aaron Hay is audio engineer, and Travis McMillan is director. For all of us at Global Journalist, I'm Jason McClure. Thanks for tuning in.